Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the most important facets of that war is now, unfortunately, on the home front. Most of us are unaware of it, or certainly don't recognize it for what it is. It seems increasingly a wholesale assault by what I think of as the red-green axis, the radical left on the one hand, the red, and their allies, unlikely though this may seem, the green of the Islamist stripe. It is always a pleasure, therefore, to be able to talk to a man who is, well, monumentally contributing to both our understanding of that front in this war and also helping to push back against our enemies, foreign and domestic. He is Trevor Louden, the creator of a number of products under the banner The Enemies Within, a book, a documentary film of that name, also churning out now with great regularity shorter documentary videos under the banner America Under Siege. The most recent one is subtitled Antifa, and we're anxious to talk with him about that organization and others. Trevor Louden, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Look, it's great to be on, Frank. Thanks so much.
Well, it's great to have you in particular because I want to talk with you about something that is now looming, scheduled, I'm told, for the 4th of November in a number of cities across the country. It is a project of something called Refuse Fascism, which I must say I hadn't heard of before this warning came out. Tell us, Trevor, based on your extensive research of the communists and socialists and progressives and their allies, what do we know about Refuse Fascism and what is it they are telling us they're going to do?
Yeah, look, Refuse Fascism is a front for the Revolutionary Communist Party. Now, it's been the Revolutionary Communist Party has been around since the 60s. It came out of the SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, and it was run by a man called Bob Avakian, who was for many years in exile in Paris. Now, everybody's seen the RCP. If you've seen pictures on TV of American flags being burnt at rallies, that is the Revolutionary Communist Party.
These are, in other words, violent revolutionaries, not simply people who seek to overthrow our country through, you know, peaceful democratic means. Is that right?
No, they're extremely violent, and they have been actively recruiting felons from the prisons over the last few years. They send a lot of literature in the prisons, and they do that through a global exchange, which has tax-exempt status. So they are extremely violent, one of the most violent communist groups in the country by far.
And what are they telling us they're going to do on the 4th of November, Trevor Louden?
Well, they're going to start an insurrection. This is their word, an insurrection against the Trump administration. It's sort of, I believe it's modeled on the Arab Spring. They want to start a series of rolling demonstrations and street rallies and protests that build and build in intensity and riots. And I believe they will also, in my opinion, they'll also try and attack power plants, and they will block highways and motorways.
And they've already been doing some of that, as I understand, in Los Angeles. Is that right?
Yeah, I think this is probably a trial run, because they're very strong in Los Angeles. They were very actively involved in the Los Angeles riots of 1992, which gives you some indication of how violent these people are.
Now, in our country, Trevor Louden, and I want our audience to understand, of course, they're listening to your accent, you have become part of the freedom fighting team here in America, but you hail from New Zealand originally. But in our country, it is actually illegal to incite or conspire to incite rioting in our country across interstate lines at the federal level in particular. It would sound as though what these folks have in mind and are about would violate, at the very minimum, that statute. Should there be an effort made now to roll these guys up?
Yeah, look, they absolutely should be. They're committing felonies here. And we remember the famous case of the Chicago 7 back in 1968, where these guys were arrested for inciting the huge riots at the Democratic Party National Convention that year that caused huge chaos in Chicago, extreme violence. And 7 guys were arrested and prosecuted and jailed for crossing state lines to incite a riot. Well, these refuse fascism people and their Black Lives Matter allies and their Antifa allies are doing that on a daily basis. And I think it's time for the federal authorities to step in now.
Yeah. Let me ask you about two other elements to this, if I could, just to sort of stitch out the complexion of this group. What role, if any, as far as you can tell, are Muslim Brotherhood elements playing in this sort of revolutionary enterprise in our country?
Look, extensive. There is a very deep tie-up, for instance, between Black Lives Matter and Muslim Brotherhood front groups. And, Nihad Awad is famous, the leader of CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, a long-time revolutionary with a foot in both camps, is very actively supporting Black Lives Matter.
I believe he's actually called it our movement at one point.
Our movement, he did. He makes it very clear. And members of leaders of Black Lives Matter have twice gone to delegations to the occupied territories in Israel to meet with members of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which is a designated communist terrorist organization. You know, Laila Khaled, the famous airline hijacker of the 70s, is one of their most well-known members. So there's a huge tie between the Muslim Brotherhood and these anarchists.
Okay. And secondly, what about George Soros? We've just been told that he's going to be presumably ramping up enormously his operations worldwide, but also in our country, with the transfer of something on the order of $18 billion to his sort of operations, his foundation. What are the implications of that, given what you know about the role that he's been playing in some of these projects?
Well, to dump $18 billion into the revolution, that is just so significant, it's unbelievable. And he must be committing so many felonies, you wouldn't be able to count them.
Now, he would say he's just dumping it into his foundation, but Trevor Loudon, based on your research on the enemies within, is there any doubt that is, as a practical matter, a prime mover behind this revolutionary enterprise?
Look, absolutely. He put $50,000, which is chicken feed by his standards. That went straight into the coffers of refused fascism recently. So his money is going to groups like the Revolutionary Communist Party, the most extreme violent organization in the country. And he's put huge amounts of money into Black Lives Matter as well, which is controlled by the Freedom Road Socialist Organization, which is a pro-Chinese Maoist outfit. So at what point does the federal government decide that we're at war here and that there's a man openly financing this war, an insurrection against the United States government? You know, why is this allowed to continue?
This is a topic for another conversation with you, Trevor Loudon. I know from your masterwork, The Enemies Within, Communists, Socialists, and Progressives in the U.S. Congress, that some of the answer may lie there. We will have you back very soon to discuss it and much more. But in the meantime, thank you, Trevor, for the extraordinary work you do and your contribution to our understanding of the enemy within and what we had best be doing about it. It seems to me, to answer your question, the time for this kind of action against Soros and his entities that he's enabling is now. Thank you, sir. We'll talk with you again soon. Next up, we'll speak with another serious student of these matters, Dr. Scott Powell, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Dr. Scott Powell. He is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute in Washington State. He is also a very active contributor to a terrific online resource, The American Thinker. He has served in a number of capacities, including as a fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution, but he is really a prolific and very thoughtful analyst of what we are facing, particularly in the way of the, well, I sort of think of it as social, cultural, and societal challenges of our time, primarily from the red-green axis. He is the author of Covert Cadre, which was an incredibly important book about this sort of activity decades ago and focused on a group called the Institute for Policy Studies, or IPS. We'll talk with him about that and much more. I'm very pleased to say, welcome back, Scott. Thank you so much for taking some time with us.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm interested in particular, Scott, in a piece that you wrote recently in The American Thinker about George Orwell. And you call to mind a number of his most important insights, notably in Animal Farm and 1984. But talk about him in the context of our time and the challenges that we're currently facing.
I think it's safe to say that George Orwell was a prophet. I can't say that he was ahead of his time because he looked at the world and wrote about it at a time when totalitarianism was already well established. Of course, it was established by Lenin in the Russian Revolution. And he wrote Animal Farm in the 1940s and 50s. And his purpose really was to explain how freedom is best his loss to totalitarianism and the intolerance that accompanies it. And I think this is one of the defining characteristics of the time in which we live. The area that concerns me most is the attack on our First Amendment, freedom of speech. Intolerance has really sought to silence discussion about very important issues, be it radical Islam or be it the internal enemies that are operating within the United States.
And as you look at those enemies, describe how you would best characterize them. Do you see, as I do, a convergence of unlikely comrades, shall we say, those of the radical left, perhaps notably of the IPS ilk, with the Islamists, who are not naturally aligned in the same end state, but nonetheless willing to make common cause with them?
Well, both have the same objective, and that is to take the United States down, to dismantle our country, to undermine and destroy its constitution. They both have that same objective. Now, alone, perhaps neither one of them could accomplish that, but together, they're more likely to be successful. And so it's a, you might call it an alliance of necessity to achieve their objective.
Marriage of convenience. Yeah, lots of different ways to think of it.
Yeah, it's an alliance of convenience. And we've seen throughout history that can, you know, fundamentally different groups can make alliances together to achieve a common goal. The United States allied itself with the Soviet Union to fight Hitler. So this is not unprecedented.
Right. To the contrary, there's a lot of bad history here for the world. You've also written recent, Scott Powell, at The American Thinker, about one of Orwell's most profound insights, in a way, his comment that he who controls the past controls the future. Would you talk about that in the context of what the totalitarians are up to at the moment with respect to tearing down statues and otherwise trying to remake, rewrite, or simply dispense with the history of our country? What's that about?
Well, the history of our country is absolutely extraordinary. There has been no country in human history that has a founding as profound as ours. You know, there were there were 55 signers of the Declaration of Independence. There were 36 signers of the Constitution. There were more contributors than that. But these people that came together to found this nation were in a class by themselves. It is absolutely extraordinary. And the history of our country, while it wasn't, you know, a perfect country when it was founded, the Constitution made provisions for change and growth and correcting injustices. And indeed, we fought a bloody war. The Civil War, by some estimates, took 800,000 Americans were killed to keep the nation united and to free the nation from the scourge of slavery. That was a huge price that the country paid, but it was all made possible through its founding, through the constitutional document. And of course, we are continuing to make progress in terms of empowerment. It took the civil rights movement of the 1960s, largely under the leadership of Martin Luther King, to advance that cause. But the left want to basically disconnect American people from their heritage so that they don't feel, if you don't feel good about your country, how are you going to fight for your country?
How are you going to even really understand that it's worth fighting for and that you will therefore be less prepared to sacrifice, for sure, but perhaps even to even pay attention as it is under assault from those like the red-green axis? And Scott, let me just come back to your important book. I believe 1988 was the year it was published, Covert Cadre. The Institute for Policy Studies was a hardcore anti-American leftist organization. It seems as though there are scores of them these days. Talk, if you would, a little bit about the role that these kinds of outfits play, and in particular, the role being played in enabling their contribution to the takedown of America from within. That seems to be the object of George Soros, who we learned this week, horrifyingly, is now transferred $18 billion to an Open Societies Institute foundation that he uses to fund such operations as, I believe, IPS, but certainly many others that are ominous today.
Well, the genius of IPS, if I could say it had genius, was that it became an institution that could spawn many other organizations. You would come to IPS, be trained, be empowered, and go off and create a new entity, a new nonprofit institution with what ostensibly appeared to be a separate and independent voice. But the left is collectivist. They speak together with one voice. So as more and more organizations have proliferated on the left, the power of propaganda grows. And in a sense, it almost dominates the airways. It dominates the public mind. And of course, you know, Orwell spoke about this, in terms of newspeak and doublethink, which is what we know now as political correctness. And newspeak is the distorted reality accomplished by manipulating the meaning of language in words, while doublethink is the conditioned mental attitude to ignore reality and common sense and substitute and embrace a distorted or false narrative. And that is what is happening in the United States today.
Fantastically insightful stuff. We need you back, Scott, soon, if you could. I think this requires a much deeper drill down, and if you'll find some time for us, we'd love to do that at the nearest possible moment. Thank you for your contributions these days to the Discovery Institute's work and to our understanding of the challenges of our time at the American Thinker and elsewhere. And do let's come back together soon. Next up, Bill Gertz joins us. We'll talk with him about Xi's China dream, America's nightmare. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a pleasure to say, joined by Richard Fisher, one of the truly preeminent authorities in our country, about what communist China is up to in the way of threats to this country and, for that matter, our vital interests around the world. Rick is a senior fellow with the International Assessment and Strategy Center and the author, most recently, of Chinese Military Power, Building for Regional and Global Reach. Rick Fisher, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you, Frank.
Let me ask you, Rick, if you could quickly summarize what insights we should take away from the, I don't know, 3.5 hours worth of speechifying that President Xi Jinping delivered at this party Congress the other day. I guess distilled to its essence, it's all about his China dream. But what is that dream, and is it likely to be a nightmare for us?
Yes, it is, Frank, and it'll be a nightmare well within our lifetimes. Xi Jinping pledged in the course of his three-hour speech to have the Chinese People's Liberation Army, achieve, quote, world-class status by 2050. Now, that's a nebulous phrase, but for the Chinese, it means a People's Liberation Army that is more powerful than the military forces of the United States, with a fully globally projected Navy, Air Force, and Air Mobile Army forces, probably having achieved control of the Earth-Moon system, and fully able to support new autocracies and dictatorships that it will likely help to create around the world.
Now, Rick, you're saying this on the basis not just of the rhetoric coming out of Xi Jinping and others in the Chinese leadership, but on the basis of your close study of actual programs being put into place, industrial capabilities to support those programs, as well as evidence that has come our way of the doctrinal and strategic planning activities of the Chinese Communist Party and its People's Liberation Army. Is that right?
Yes, Frank. Since the unfortunate events of Tiananmen Square in 1989, the Chinese Communist Party has decided, in order to survive, it must not change and reform internally. It must not move toward pluralism, but it instead must reach out well beyond its borders and defeat any potential challenges to the dictatorship of the Communist Party. And militarily, this has meant that since the early 1990s, China has invested massively in the creation of a fourth-generation equivalent American military capability, which is now basically coming online. And investments in a fifth generation have been underway for probably 15 or more years, but China is also investing in a sixth generation of capability, one that will include broad weaponization of information, energy weapons, and dominance of space, outer space. And that could emerge by the end of the 2020s and into the 2030s.
Now, I know you're mostly focused on what the Chinese are up to in all of these areas and more, Rick Fisher, but just for purposes of comparison, you mentioned an American fourth generation, with the notable exception of, I guess, the F-22 and the F-35, sort of fifth generation aircraft. is it fair to say that we are not actively bringing online much in the way of a fifth generation capability of our own, let alone introducing in appreciable ways something in the way of a sixth generation in space or terrestrially or otherwise?
Frank, your concern is absolutely correct. The American force remains largely a fourth generation in terms of platforms. Now, what the U.S. has done and or has tried to do with some efficiency is upgrade electronics, upgrade connectivity, upgrade the integration of advanced information systems to allow fourth generation platforms to operate in an increasingly fifth generation realm. The Chinese are doing this as well. The ACME goal of the American Air Force for the coming decade is to integrate fifth generation platforms like the F-35 with fourth generation platforms like F-16s or F-16s with upgraded electronics. The Chinese understand this and are doing the same thing. They understand that fifth generation systems are expensive. They can't produce that many, although they're going to try, but building many 4+ or 4++ generation platforms is a much more efficient way to proceed and integrate them along with fifth generation platforms. Now, as for the American investment in sixth generation technologies, it's there, but I suspect that the Chinese investment could overtake us if we don't wake up and start upping our own game.
Speaking of all of this, Rick, one of the places that I've been particularly concerned about, as I think you have, is the evidence that the Chinese are now increasingly building to exercise dominion over choke points around the world that could greatly interfere with our ability to project power in the defense of our vital interests, our allies, or both. When you look at, for example, Taiwan at the moment and what the Chinese are positioning themselves to do, there was some thought that Xi may say explicitly there will be a certain point by which time Taiwan will be conquered by the Chinese Communist Party and its military. But beyond Taiwan, in the Caribbean, in the South China Sea, in the Horn of Africa, and elsewhere, we're watching inexorably power projection capabilities being put into place that can, as you say, interfere with our vital interests and the protection thereof. Let's start with Taiwan quickly and then just walk us through what else is happening in this space that we should be concerned about.
Well, Frank, indeed, the PLA is building up toward another try at taking Taiwan, perhaps as early as the early to mid-2020s. The Chinese are not advertising this goal, such as announcing it at the Party Congress, because they seek to conceal so much of their preparations. But the time is coming where Taiwan will be offered a fait accompli, surrender or be killed. Now, indeed, China has been investing in maritime choke points, trying to gain control of ports. Of course, their base in Djibouti, they're very intense focus on the Malacca Straits, and the building of multiple water or land canals up and down Latin America. In addition to that, Frank, the Chinese are working on an ability to deny thousands of kilometers of space in the world's oceans by virtue of a likely intention to put on surface ships and perhaps even submarines their new anti-ship ballistic missile, or ASBM. The ASBM initially gives them a strike range of 1,500 kilometers, although a new land-based ASBM has a range of up to 4,000 kilometers. And these will now be placed on ships along with maneuverable warheads that are very difficult to shoot down. This will allow the Chinese Navy to exercise sea denial thousands of kilometers away from their warships.
Rick Fisher, we have to leave it at that. An ominous note, needless to say, but one that ought to be concentrating our minds as we watch what the Chinese are not only saying, but what they're doing. Nobody does that better than you. Rick Fisher of the International Assessment and Strategy Center, thank you for all your good work and for joining us from time to time to discuss it. We'll look forward to picking up with you again in the near future. In the meantime, we'll turn next to Frank Calzone and take stock of what the Cubans are doing against our diplomats and vital interests and more straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined by Frank Calzone, one of our duty experts on matters involving our hemisphere, specifically with respect to the nature of and future prospects concerning Cuba, a land he fled during the early days of the Castro takeover there, and has worked ever since tirelessly to try to liberate from the communist regime of first Fidel and now Raul Castro. He is doing that these days as the executive director of a terrific organization, the Center for a Free Cuba. And we've been anxious to catch up with Frank to talk about the latest developments concerning what somebody in Cuba, presumably with at least the connivance, if not the direct involvement of the Castro regime, has been doing to our diplomats. Frank, thank you so much for taking a few minutes. Welcome back.
Thanks for inviting me.
So what is the latest? We've been talking about this story for a bit with you, Frank, but it seems as though the number of diplomats who have been afflicted and the damage that has been done to them becomes more severe by the day. Is that the case?
Well, the more and more information is coming out. Apparently now not only diplomats, but other American tourists have been affected. The administration has put a warning alerting Americans about several hotels where this thing happened. And the administration, the president has said that he believes that the Cuban government is involved. There's no question that Havana has failed to fulfill its obligations of protecting American diplomats in Cuba.
And the nature of the problem, as I understand it, is that there's been some sort of sonic phenomenon that has been directed at these individuals, whether they're diplomats or other Americans in the country. And it has been causing damage to their brains, their hearing, their memories, and so on. Is that correct, Frank?
Yeah, what we do know is a number of 20-some American diplomat, I believe also two Canadians, have been injured, and that this is a serious matter, and the United States has brought out 60% of its diplomatic personnel in Cuba, and that the Cuban government first said that they didn't know what happened, then said that nothing really had happened, that this was simply hysterics from the Americans in an effort to damage relations with Havana.
And Frank, it is damaging relations with Havana, needless to say, not because we wanted it to, but because of the nature of this travesty. There is talk about closing the U.S. embassy in Havana. Do you think that's in the cards? And at the very least, shouldn't we be closing the Cuban embassy here in the United States?
Well, the administration sent back to Cuba the same percentage of Cuban diplomats. The situation now is that definitely Mr. Trump has said that until everybody realizes what the situation is and that measures are taken so that this will not happen to American diplomats in Cuba, they're not going to go back. There is a letter to the president by a number of former diplomats professors and a group of people that are very concerned about the situation, in which they asked the president to make sure that the situation is resolved, but also they say that until a number of pending matters between the two countries are resolved, that the United States should not send the diplomats back. Some of those issues are, for example, the presence of thousands of military personnel helping Mr. Maduro in Venezuela.
And I wanted to talk to you about that, among several other aspects of Cuban behavior that's very problematic. But just before we leave this, Frank, would you recommend to the President of the United States that he send the rest of the Cuban staff in the embassy here back as well? I mean, shouldn't we be establishing that there are real consequences for this kind of these attacks against American personnel?
Well, I'm sure the president knows a lot more about the details than I do. But the fact remains that if Cuba wants to have normal relations with the United States, then this kind of behavior is not acceptable. The White House has said that they are convinced that the Cuban government, at the very least, could have stopped the attacks.
You've been very diplomatic, Frank, and I appreciate that. Let me turn to the topic that you mentioned a moment ago, what the Cubans are doing outside of their country. We have real reason to be concerned that they are materially contributing to the ongoing repression in Venezuela of the regime of Nicolas Maduro. They're also involved elsewhere in the hemisphere, including, as I understand it, in our own country, in espionage and other kinds of subversive behavior. Characterize, if you would, whether there has been any appreciable amelioration of all of this during the presidency of Raul Castro.
Well, there's no question that while the apologists for the Cuban dictatorship claim that the Cold War ended between Washington and Havana as a result of Mr. Obama's diplomacy, the facts indicate otherwise. The U.S. made many concessions to Havana, but Havana continued all along its anti-American behavior. For example, during the negotiations with the United States, again, under the previous administration, Russian spy ships returned to Havana Harbor. During that time, Havana continued its very active association with North Korea. Havana was caught trying to smuggle warplanes and missiles to North Korea. Mr. Obama's White House said that, well, it did happen. The United Nations put out a report condemning Cuba, but the White House back then didn't feel it was important enough to halt the process. There are many, many different things that continue even to this day. For example, Havana continues to allow terrorists in Havana, Americans that are wanted by the FBI. All those issues were ignored during the Obama administration. They should be part of the agenda of the president. The president has asked the FBI, the Justice Department, to provide him information on the issue of the terrorists that are held in Havana by the Castro government. So it remains, things are going slow. The key people at the State Department that should enforce the new administration's policy are many of them, many positions remain to be filled. And unfortunately, personnel is policy. So until the president has people who support his policy in key positions at the State Department, we will have there the same folks that were implementing the previous policy. And I'm sure there's a pushback at the State Department on many of these issues.
It reminds me of nothing so much as Obama's third term, that we have those folks, as you say, Frank Calzone, who are supportive of the previous policy, that in some cases actually were involved in implementing it, of normalizing relations with the Castro regime, and otherwise propping it up. Frank, there's much more to talk about this subject and others that you focus on at the Center for a Free Cuba. We look forward to doing so with you in the near future. Thank you so much for taking time today, and come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afty. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.